From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Pittsburgh, California.
Oh, I'm not from the Bay Area.
Pinole, California.
Pinole, California.
San Jose.
I'm from Paradise, California, up north.
San Jose. South San Jose.
Coming up, we'll find out why San Francisco is moving tons of sand down Ocean Beach.
Just a couple weeks ago, we saw another 4 feet of that parking lot down there by Sloat fall off the cliff.
Then a poet and cartoonist tells us why she loves making comics.
That's magic, and I want to do magic all day, so, yeah.
And we find out the answer to this week's Audiograph Mystery Sound.
Raise up, draw back.
One, two, let go.
Bullseye, today on Cross Currents. For the past couple weeks, an unusual scene has been playing out at Ocean Beach. Huge dump trucks have been hauling loads of sand from the north end of the beach near the beach chalet, 2.5 miles down the Great Highway to the intersection of Sloat Boulevard, which is eroding fast. It's just one battle in a war between man and Mother Nature that's been going on at the beach for decades. Now the city has a new plan of attack. KALW's Audrey Dilling has the story.
In this war, San Francisco's tanks look more like Tonka trucks. The dump trucks line up along the beach. A machine with a huge scoop at the end fills each one up with sand. Then they turn around and head south in an orderly procession. They dump the sand and turn around and come back. They're doing this until they've moved all the sand they need to move, which is a lot of sand.
Well, we have a calculation of about 37,000 tons. So we're going to do about 1,000 truckloads in the course of the next few weeks.
Gene Walsh is with the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission, or SFPUC. The point is to protect a water treatment plant the SFPUC operates down near Sloat Boulevard. There's a pipe there that releases treated wastewater into the ocean. The sand surrounding the pipe plays a big role in protecting it from being battered by waves. But the ocean currents have a habit of sweeping that sand miles away, all the way up to the beach where Walsh and I are standing, leaving the area around the plant vulnerable.
Just a couple weeks ago, we saw another 4 feet of that parking lot down there by Sloat fall off the cliff, basically. So, it's just a constant battle.
It really is a battle. There are even ruins. The erosion has exposed a couple of old seawalls and the remnants of a pedestrian tunnel built about 100 years ago. Artifacts from times we've tried to hold off the sea and failed. But in the case of the sewer plant, we can't give up.
Well, we would never let this happen. So worst case scenario, if that got exposed and somehow ruptured, we'd have a sewage spill into the Pacific Ocean.
The wastewater plant was built in 1993. Soon after that, the city noticed the erosion problem and responded aggressively, installing concrete barriers around the pipe and along the beach. The barriers worked, but environmentalists and beach visitors weren't happy about the jagged blocks cluttering the shoreline. Meanwhile, storms continued to ravage the coastline south of Sloat. So the city tried to get a permit to build more barriers, but the California Coastal Commission denied it and said they needed a new strategy. Hence, the dump trucks. They first showed up in 2012.
I never remembered them doing this at all when I was growing up. So.
Pierre Braganza is a civilian bystander in this war. He grew up out here in the Sunset District.
I've been out here my whole life, and it's funny because, you know, the stairs, I remember as a kid, you used to run down these stairs, and it was kind of long.
Nowadays, you don't even need the stairs sometimes because the sand is piled so high.
You know, I guess you gotta, you know, be a little bit proactive, or else nature would probably just take over everything, you know?
A lot of this area actually used to belong to the sea. Early San Franciscans pushed the beach about 200 feet west to level out dunes and make room for the Great Highway, the road that runs parallel to the shoreline. And ever since, the ocean has been trying to advance its way back, eroding the land under the road or covering it with enough sand that it often needs to be closed and cleared out during windy months. The city knows this, which is why the dump trucks aren't a permanent solution.
You can have free-flowing traffic, you can have a wastewater infrastructure system, and you can have a sandy beach. You can sort of have any two of those three, but you really can't have them all.
Benjamin Grant is Urban Design Policy Director for the city planning think tank SPUR, and he's landed himself in the position of Commander-in-Chief of San Francisco's long-term battle plan against erosion and sea level rise. For the past 5 years, Grant and his army of SPUR staff have been concocting a strategy that takes everyone's needs into account: environmental agencies, beach visitors, wildlife. It's called the Ocean Beach Master Plan. Grant says they had three main tactics to choose from. One, coastal armoring,
which stops the erosion, but also often degrades the landscape or the beach.
Like what the SFPUC already tried with the concrete barriers. Two, a full-on attack, padding the beach with a lot more sand to make it wider and hold off the ocean. That's like what the dump trucks are doing. Not a good long-term solution. So SPUR has landed on a third option.
What's called managed retreat, which is essentially realigning threatened assets away from the erosion hazard.
In other words, we're giving the land back to the sea. Well, parts of it. The problem stretch of the Great Highway south of Slope Boulevard, the plan says that should go away as soon as 2020. And with traffic gone, the area returned to a natural coastal landscape. There will still be some protections around the treatment plant, but they won't need to work as hard, thanks to the other adaptations. At least, that's the idea. The Ocean Beach Master Plan is a series of recommendations that all need to get their own green light, by the city or the Coastal Commission, or for some of them, both. Grant says that'll take work, but if it gets passed, it would be huge.
The Ocean Beach Master Plan is one of the first examples of a specific location having a detailed long-term climate adaptation plan.
That means it could become a model for other areas.
What we see at Ocean Beach today is a condition that we're likely to see much more broadly in 50 and 100 years.
The science supports this. A recent study found that seas rose at a faster rate in the last century than in any of the 27 before it.
So if we can develop the tools and techniques and planning processes to adapt at places like Ocean Beach, we'll be able to apply those tools much more broadly as the serious consequences of sea level rise set in.
At Ocean Beach, Jean Walsh from the SFPUC says she's on board with the plan and ready to retreat.
So we're saying, let the ocean take what it wants, and let's bow out gracefully and put our road back there where it's safe. We don't have to fight this battle every year.
So so Mother Nature is winning right now?
Yeah, I would say so.
And then in down the line in, say, 50 years, we'll be sort of at a truce, maybe?
I hope so. After a lot of money spent and a lot of thought put into it, and hopefully we'll come up with a sustainable long-term plan that works for everyone.
Including the ocean. In San Francisco, I'm Audrey Dilling for Cross Currents.
Listening to Cross Currents from KALW News, I'm Hannah Baba. The ocean has had a strong presence in the life of Oakland-based poet and cartoonist Trinidad Escobar. She was born in 1986 during a typhoon in the Philippines. She was adopted by a family in the U.S. and grew up an ocean away from her original homeland. She's currently working on a graphic memoir about her experience as a transnational adoptee, but her work is wide-ranging, from deep explorations of race and class to Star Wars fan art and sweet comics about the adventures of her two young sons. Trinidad Escobar talked to KALW's Jen Sheehan about drawing from her imagination.
People often have a preconceived notion about what comics or cartoons are. And also, it used to be that the worlds of illustration art and fine art, or so-called high art, were very separate. But there's been this whole generation now of artists kind of blurring that line. And it's a lot of them have come from this kind of giant robot, Asian American or API movement or lineage. Do you feel like a part of that kind of wave?
I know that world has really influenced me. I'm not exactly sure where I fit in, and I think that can be a good thing. I am currently working with a publisher called Rosarium Publishing and an art collective called Orpheus Forge. We do very similar things, have very similar outlooks on what comics can do. And so we take our backgrounds, whether that's our queer identity, our people of color, you know, experiences, and shape stories that include us in the future and hammer the future, what we believe that can look like, which I think has been different from my experience with the wave that brought me here. The wave that brought me here with Asian Americans was, this is where we came from, and know this so that you know where you're going. And the place I'm in right now is more like, let's make our future. Let's show people that we exist in sci-fi, because sci-fi is just the future written out in all its possibility.
Are you saying that quote-unquote identity politics or identity issues are not as important to you in your work as a previous generation would have thought?
Identity politics and talking about I am Filipino, I am this, is not as is not spoken with the same words, with the same language now for me. So in some works, I might be talking about my history and then personal stories of whether that's immigration for my family or my adoption story, and how that relates to Philippine history or Filipino-American history. And I also think that it's important to go the other way. So the other way would be, let me just tell you my experience, and that also counts as Filipino-American. Let me just tell you this intimate thing without saying the words identity politics, without saying this or that.
It's just who you are. So that's what you're bringing. Your subjects for your art run the gamut. It's like you're filtering your experience of the world through your work. Can you talk about that process of how you just choose what you draw and how does that work?
Right now, you know, stuff that's on my website, some of the like doodles in the blog section, the short comics and comic strips, those are just for fun and to like let off some steam. And then
some of them are about the funny and strange things that your kids do.
Yeah. And then my short comic section, which have mini comics and animated comics on there, are more stories that I think can reflect my experiences as a Filipino American, but taking the very, very intimate route into those experiences. For example, my story, Silently Gathering Force, is ultimately about adoption, one piece of my experience with adoption. But instead of saying adoption does this, this, and this, and sometimes it's not so good because of A, B, and C, I say, okay, there's one thing that happened to me, and this is what I used to think about when this thing happened. And I remember thinking when I was a child, if this is happening to me here, maybe there's another me somewhere else not experiencing that. And what would that look like?
And so this is a short comic on your website where it's from the point of view of a young girl imagining an alternate reality for herself.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Which I think is common for a lot of young kids, have this rudimentary understanding
that there could be another way that things could have gone or that are going.
That are currently going.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That short comic, Silently Gathering Force, is very, I found it very moving, very beautiful and intimate. How does that experience of being a transnational adoptee affect your work?
Oh, it's in almost everything. I returned to my family to meet them when I was a teenager.
And when did you leave them? How old were you?
I was an infant, so I was about 3 months old. And I always knew I was adopted. I was raised knowing I was and always accepted it. I had, you know, some kids at school make fun of me from time to time, and I never really understood that. I felt a lot of pain and didn't know how to articulate that. And when I saw my birth family, I realized, like, there's been something missing. You know, even though my parents were pretty loving to me here, my adoptive parents, there's something that really affected me because I had no choice in leaving. And I wasn't able to have any memories or experiences with my birth family. So when I went back, I realized this and, you know, kept it with me as I was writing and exploring different forms of art.
What kinds of things are you able to do in the comic or graphic memoir form that you wouldn't be able to do if you were, say, writing a book that was just text?
I think that for a lot of storytelling with prose, I can easily write how I feel and describe it. Using metaphor and things that aren't so direct, I could show with my writing. But what if I can show the complexity in one panel? So let's say I'm very happy that I was adopted because I had all these opportunities and was able to go on and get a master's degree and no one else in my family has been to college. But at the same time, I was incredibly broken. So I can take a chapter to talk about that and then take another chapter to write about, you know, being happy. But I can also do that in one panel. Words can say, you know, things were okay growing up. And in the image, in that same panel, the juxtaposed image shows me trying to deal, me crying, me at a fair at Great America holding cotton candy and not smiling. That does something very different to someone's emotional response
than just saying something. I was not happy. Mm-hmm. Or
yes.
Describing in words.
Yeah, I think that a lot of emotions, complex emotions, can be captured instantaneously with comics that kind of have to be carved out with words.
That was poet and cartoonist Trinidad Escobar speaking with KELW's Jen Sheehan. You can see Trinidad's work at the Quintohan Comics exhibit at the I Hotel Manila Town Center in San Francisco until April 17th. All the details are at KALW.org. Click on Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba, and now it's time for Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. Here's KALW's Julie Kane.
All week long, we've been playing you this sound.
Raise up, draw back.
One, two, let go.
We started coming out here because I got a target and stuff like that. It was really, really fun to do.
Think you know what that was and where we recorded it? We sent KALW's Luisa Cardosa to Golden Gate Park to tell us more.
If you've ever been to the Outside Lands Music Festival at the Polo Fields on the other side of Golden Gate Park, the archery range would probably fit in one corner. There are 8 large targets set up, each about 10 feet apart, and standing at varying distances from the main path at the edge of the range. I'm here with Scott Bullard, certified archery coach, and we are about to shoot some arrows.
Down relaxed. Raise up. Draw back.
One, two, let go.
Bullard works at the San Francisco Archery Shop about 10 blocks from the park and gives lessons almost daily. A lot of people are into archery these days as the sport has become so visible in the pop culture. There's Merida from the Disney movie Brave, Clint Barton and Oliver Queen from the comic books Hawkeye and Green Arrow, and of course, Katniss.
Katniss Everdeen?
The stakes are certainly not as high here in the park as they are in the Hunger Games, but honing your skills takes just as much patience and a lot of practice shots.
And that might be best phrased as forming an association between the feeling of your shot and the result on the target.
In other words, knowing what it feels like to land that arrow every time. Archery is a lot more physical than folks might think. During my lesson, I become very aware of my core, which supports my upper back muscles, my neck, and shoulder blades. Those muscles help me raise the bow and have an open rather than collapsed stance.
Archery is an endurance sport, so we want that last arrow to be as good as the first.
People have been shooting arrows at targets here in Golden Gate Park for over 130 years, and there's a wide variety of folks who use the range, from recreational shooters to seasoned bow hunters. After a few more practice shots, Bullard decides to shoot some arrows on his own, so I take a walk around the range to see who else is practicing. The first person I meet is a local beginner, 11-year-old Dorothy Holt.
We started coming out here because I got a target and stuff like that. It was really, really fun to do. Yeah! I hit that time.
Dorothy is one of many young women who've started coming to the range in recent years. I ask her if archery is something she wants to pursue as a sport.
I just want to keep going at it, be able to pick up a bow and arrow and shoot.
I keep walking and bump into David Chan.
Hi there. Are you David?
If you spend any time here at the range, you'll probably bump into him too. Chan is head coach of the local chapter of the Junior Olympics Archery Development Program, known as the JOAD. He's also one of the volunteers who maintains the targets.
When we were using hay bales, the bales would last about 3 months, and then we'd have to replace the whole bale.
They're now made of rolled-up window screening, encased in wooden boxes, and covered in plastic burlap. But they still need a lot of maintenance. The fire department donates expired fire hose to use as protective edging.
If you hit steel with an arrow, it'll shatter the arrow. So we put the covering on it to help protect something. Try to protect the arrow from getting destroyed when it hits the steel bar.
And speaking of destruction, the archery range is completely unregulated. I asked Chan about the delicate dance of allowing people to manage their own experiences. He says the biggest problem is when people shoot broadhead arrows, which are highly destructive hunting arrows.
We label all the signs with no broadheads allowed, and we still find broadheads in the bales, and they just destroy the bales way faster than anything else.
They were designed for war and have sharp blades that tear up the targets almost instantly. So what happens when Chan sees a shooter using these forbidden arrows?
When someone's holding a weapon like that, you do not confront them. Most of the rangers have given us their personal cell phone numbers so that we can call them directly.
Most people, though, follow the rules. Some regulars, like Patrick Hutchins, even have a favorite spot.
Like that's actually our favorite bale, is the just natural hay. Because the arrows, they stick in there and they stay at that angle. With the other bales, sometimes if, you know, the middles get eaten out of them, and so arrow will go in and it'll just sag, and we've shot our own arrows by the side, you know, and broadsided them.
Occupational hazard.
Yeah, exactly. Cost of the hobby.
Before I pack up for the day, I decide to take one last shot. I stand with an open stance, draw back my arrow, and aim.
Ooh.
Nice.
Yeah.
Bullseye. In Golden Gate Park, I'm Luisa Cardoza for Cross Currents.
Our winner this week is Audiograph superfan Robert Weiner. Congratulations, Robert. We're going to send you a KALW t-shirt. For the rest of you, we'll have a new mystery sound next week. Ready for your sneak listen? Here we go.
Every other Wednesday and every Friday and Saturday night, it's nothing but drag, drag, drag.
How are we all doing tonight? You guys ready to see a fabulous show?
I'm 60, almost 60 friggin' 4 years old, and I'm still doing this because I love it.
Think you know what that was and where we recorded it? Give us a call and tell us. 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. We'll tell you the story behind the sound next week. Until then, thanks for listening and thanks for playing. I'm Julie Kane.
Thanks, Julie. If you've got ideas for where we should record next, tell us about them at news@kalw.org. Because of you, we can proudly say we're listener-supported public radio. Our team includes Shireen Adil, Leela Day, Nina Gensler-Debs, Angela Johnston, Casey Miner, Ted Muldoon, Raja Shah, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. The line producer was Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This is Carolina Lugo and Carole Acuña of the group Ballet Flamenco. The mom and daughter duo play and dance almost every Saturday at 7 o'clock at the Peña Pachamama Center in San Francisco. And we have a cross-current story about the duo. Check it out at KALW.org and click on Cross Currents. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.